Today we have a remarkable guest. Meet Paul McCarroll, a mental health recovery trainer from North Ireland. Paul not only overcame OCD, leading to a hospital stay in his teens, but now works in the same hospital where he was once an inpatient. His story is living proof that recovery is possible. Paul is not only a mental health advocate, but also an experienced OCD specialist, helping clients around the world. Stay tuned as we explore Paul's inspiring journey of resilience. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of The Mindful Space. Today, we have Paul McCarroll with us. How are you today?
Hi, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for making this happen all the way from Ireland, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm up in the sort of northern part of the country, based in Belfast, Michelle. So across the ocean, but yeah, it's great to connect with you.
You have to love technology, right? For allowing this to happen. It has its pros and cons. Let's ignore the 30 minutes that time took us to put all this together. Today, we're going to be talking about OCD. Right? From the mental health perspective and also from a personal healing journey, since my understanding is that you have OCD.
Yes.
Correct.
Yep.
Okay. So let's start with the basics. What is OCD?
Yeah, Michelle. And it's a great first question, because there can be a lot of misunderstandings around OCD as well. So in terms of the actual definition, it stands for obsessive compulsive disorder. Generally, two main clusters of symptoms. Generally, clients will present with what's known as obsessions, and they can include things like intrusive thoughts, which is another word. Sorry, in more everyday language, that's like unwanted thoughts. It can also be images. These can cause distress because of the nature of the actual particular thought. And generally, what people do to try and alleviate some of the anxiety, they will do some sort of compulsions. They'll do some sort of behaviors to try and minimize the anxiety that they're feeling. One thing which is quite unique about OCD is that generally people who struggle with the condition know what they're doing is irrational. They have a sense that what they're doing doesn't make sense, but they still feel compelled to do the behavior. So it's really over time helping the client to see the condition in and of itself is difficult to manage, but over time we can reduce the intensity of the thoughts and minimize the compulsions.
Yeah, I think, you know, whoever doesn't have OCD is always like, well, can they just stop doing it?
Yeah.
It's like, well, if it would be that easy, it wouldn't be a diagnosis, right?
And I think, Michelle, that's another great point, because I think that's the difference between, you know, something being a real problem in someone's life and basically somebody else's issue of having their coke cans in order or having to have things a certain way in the house. Generally, that is something that people like. They like things a certain way, but when it becomes impacting your everyday life, impacting your relationships, your ability to work, your ability to live a meaningful life, that's when it can become problematic. And because of the nature of some of the intrusive thoughts that clients struggle with, a huge part of the problem as well is people find it even hard to open up initially.
Can you maybe provide us with an example of what an obsessive behavior would look like?
Yeah, so obviously, you have the very typical standard, which people generally, when they think of OCD, they will think of, okay, well, I'm going to check that the stove's off 1,000 times. Or before I leave the house, I'm going to make sure that door is locked, not just once, but maybe 15 times, okay? So that there is, even though there's a bit of stigma around that, that still does exist within OCD. I do see clients who struggle with that sort of technical checking-like behaviors. I also work with clients who struggle with what's called pure O, which is really, if I had a camcorder and I was watching this person, behaviorally I wouldn't really see them doing anything differently, but internally it's like a hamster on a wheel. They're having a lot of difficult thoughts showing up and they really don't know how to handle them. Those thoughts can range from, they can be very scary. They can be like, oh, if I'm left alone with this knife, I could potentially harm someone. I'm driving my car, I could potentially drive into the car in front. If I'm at the top of a mountain, what would it be like to jump? Those thoughts in and of themselves, if believed to be accurate, can make you feel anxious, can affect how you behave. But over time, Michelle, and a big part of the work that I do is, none of us can stop thoughts from showing up. it's been my personal experience, my professional experience, that generally thoughts just happen, but it's what we do with them really, you know, results in either a disorder or, you know, these thoughts can show up, but they don't have to dictate how you live your life.
Yes, that definitely makes a difference. And I don't think that's just for OCD, right? Because we all have thoughts. It's what we do with them.
Michelle,
yeah, that is a great advice.
And just to, I suppose, add to that, I heard a really nice analogy recently that your internal world of thoughts, feelings, bodily sensations is very much like the weather. The weather's always present, but it's always changing. Here in Ireland, it's maybe a bit different to where you guys are. Like, we have
definitely. Here is only heat.
Okay.
One weather.
I'm jealous.
Well, maybe rains and hurricanes.
Well, we're jealous of the sunny weather. But here, you could have sun, you could have rain, you could have showers, you could have wind, you could have anything in
it. Yeah, I think it makes complete sense. I agree with both of you. And one of the first things I like to do when I do a family session, even if it's an individual, is do a genogram, right? Where I go all the way back and tell me about your family and did anybody have any mental health conditions? Because with research or without research, it's very important to have that data and definitely take it into consideration.
Are you familiar with Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz, the work of Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz? Mm-hmm. So he wrote a very pioneering book on OCD called Brainlock out over 20 years ago. He actually helped Leonardo DiCaprio in the movie of The Aviator to display some obsessive compulsive behaviors, them two work together. And the reason I really personally resonated with that book was because it had the scientific rigor, it had the research to sort of back up its claims. And really one of its claims is that a lot of the sort of messaging that OCD clients will present, a lot of the urges to do compulsive behaviors, is generally coming from like a false alarm within the brain. So I work part-time in a hospital as well, and I always use the example that there's generally a fire alarm which goes off sort of once a week. Every single time it's a test, but my body reacts as if it's the real thing and that I need to get out of here and what's going on. And within OCD, from Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz's perspective, that's almost like what's going on. When they're getting the thought that, you know what, I've checked that stove half a dozen times, but it's still not off. That's like a false alarm. But what's happening is at the time, the clients are treating it like biblical truth that they have to act upon. And even though visually they are seeing that it's off, they still have that feeling within that it's not. So it's over time, what you can learn to do is they have a really lovely line based in that whole idea of neuroplasticity, that as you change your behavior, you change your brain. And even look at my own personal experience, I did struggle with the general contamination during my own recovery journey. And how that really helped me was recognizing that, you know, this urge that I'm having, even after washing my hands 5 times, is not a real urge. It's not something I need to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. And as you walk away from the sink, you feel anxious, you feel uncertain. You begin to see over time it dissolves away. So part of facing OCD and almost beginning to see, it's not that concrete wall that your brain is saying. It's almost like a wall made of tin cans, that when you actually approach it, it begins to sort of dissolve, it begins to sort of fall apart, but it's gradually approaching it as opposed to just going straight in there.
I wanted to ask you more about your personal journey. You know, your own experience. When did it start? When did you notice that something was different? How old were you? How was the family support? How did you get through it?
Yeah, Michelle, thanks for asking that question. So I'm 37 now. So my mental health challenges began when I was 15. I'm from a very small town called Antrim, which is, I suppose, the most notorious thing it has an international airport there. It does have some lovely castle gardens and the Loch Shore, and it's outlet shopping centre. But it's a small enough town. That's where I'm originally from. I'm from a very working class background, Michelle, with a very loving, supportive mother and father. I'm one of four, and I'm also a father myself to a 4-year-old son. But growing up, I have to say, I was very fortunate in terms of my primary school education, in terms of I had very, very good life, I would say. I enjoyed sport. I was social. I connected with friends. There was nothing outwardly sort of abnormal about my behavior, about my mental health. Things began to get difficult for me in what we would call over here sort of secondary school, sort of high school. I attended a particular school which was renowned for its grades, renowned for its sort of high marks. And to be fair, I was doing very well up until sort of around sort of second, third year, where because I was doing so well, they decided to put me into a higher grade. And it's then when I really began to struggle with different things. The fact that I didn't have that same connection anymore, my friends were no longer in class. Yeah. I was quite a self-driven individual, Michelle, and I'm sure someone like yourself, Dr. Sal, people who generally do well in life, there's that part of us which pushes us forward, and it's useful. But sometimes it can be almost, it can really sort of hit you hard if you let it. So I really pushed myself hard academically, found the academic rigor very challenging, put a lot of pressure on myself. And I think eventually what happened, it almost led to burnout. And I had to come out of school. I got home tuition. And then it seemed to be then when I developed some of these sort of strange, abnormal behaviors in hindsight. It was almost, for me, the initial trauma, because sometimes trauma can be...
Okay, so for you, these were some of the triggers for your OCD.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And in hindsight, it was then... in that space, at home. And as I said, actually, in an interview which I done recently, that one of the things that which I struggled with was bad things happening to family members, you know, and like then my response to that was to do behaviors in a certain way. So I developed all these issues around numbers. I developed these issues around having to shower so many times in a day, having to wash hands, having to, you know, just at times I didn't even really bother with people. And a lot of that was around, I was so afraid that I was losing my mind. I was so afraid that I was going crazy. And so many people I've seen since with this, Michelle, that's what they think.
Okay.
You know, because they don't want to open up because they think the thoughts are bizarre. They know they're bizarre. But 20 years ago, Michelle, as I'm sure you can appreciate, there wasn't the same knowledge of mental health. It wasn't talked about. Being a guy as well, there was a bit of like, I have to man up here. I have to just deal with this.
Do you think there's a bigger stigma? Bigger stigma for males and females when it comes to OCD? Or just in general with the mental health?
Do you know what? I think, yes, Michelle, and I think that, but it's a great point because I think it's changed. I think it's getting better. I do see a lot of guys who have become very open about how they're feeling. It depends on the context, of course. I mean, I play a bit of soccer once a week with a... It's not professional or anything. I wish it was, but there's a nice social aspect to it. We all connect. We all get on. And I've often had guys at the end of the kick around, they know what I do, and they'll take me to the side and say, Paul, look, I'm struggling with this, or a family member is struggling with this. So people are becoming more open, maybe not in front of their peers, but they are willing to recognize, look, I'm struggling. How can we sort of do this better? Because unfortunately with guys, when they don't deal with things, they generally do toxic behaviors, you know.
I know it can be hard to help people with co-occurring disorders, but I want to ask you, how does medication help people with OCD?
And it's a great question, and it's something which I do see quite regularly where I may have a particular client who, you know, they have been struggling with a particular intrusive thought for such a long period of time. They'll be able to share with anybody. They have become isolated. They're not connecting. They're not working. That they probably would go under the category of clinical depression. And I personally find after doing an assessment like that, of course, I will, you know, share some resources, I'll share some psychoeducation. But generally what I will do, I will say, look, before maybe seeing you next, which maybe see your general practitioner, maybe get to see if there's any support you could be getting for maybe your low mood, your depression. Because in my experience, unless that sort of lifts, unless they get some sort of support for that, the OCD is very hard to work with. It's not saying it's impossible. I've worked with clients because, as I'm sure you know in your own practice, that medication is still a very divisive sort of subject. The way I describe medication, actually Dr. Jeffrey Schwartz shared this example and I really like it. If you're learning to swim, kids learning to swim, I know you guys use water wings, we call them armbands here. Generally what armbands or water wings do is they keep you afloat. They keep you afloat as you're going through those choppy waters until you learn how to swim. So medication can help you take the edge off those intrusive thoughts, take the edge off that sort of low mood, bring your mood up to a level that psychoeducation can then be supportive, therapy that can then be supportive. Also, a big part of what I believe in, it's just how I work, is I like to look at the human, the whole sort of organism. There's a phrase I like, that the reason we have a neck is because our body and mind is connected. So sometimes when I work with clients, I will also try to do an inventory of, like, what's your sleep like? You know, have you got to maybe halfway through the day and you're just living on coffee? You haven't had any nutritional benefit? Are you moving your body at all? Is there any exercise going on? I'd love that saying that, you know, emotion is influenced by motion. So these things won't make the OCD go away. These things won't make the depression, the personality disorder. But you need to have everything as much as possible working in your favor, because some clients come to see me, and I'm sure it's the same with you guys. They're not exactly in a great financial position. They can't just go and pay for, you know, huge amounts of therapy or go to the latest mindfulness retreat. Or so sometimes it's about, okay, well, what within your facility right now, what can you do to help? And obviously the likes of the work that you guys are doing with these sort of great interviews with great people, podcasts out there, great influencers on social media, that even if people can't, you know, go and do the expensive therapy, there's ways in, ways to sort of help. So yeah, it's a great question. Dual diagnosis is a tricky thing, I suppose, is what I would say. But there is a way around it.
Now, you mentioned medication, and I like to touch upon this subject with almost every professional that I have on the show, because everybody has their own experiences or, you know, treats differently, all the clients. So what is your take on medication? Good, bad? How do you balance it, at least in particularly OCD?
Well, I suppose, Michelle, I'll come at it first of all personally. Personally, it was an excellent lifesaver for me. Basically, part of the story that I have shared and people have really resonated with, that I do the one-on-one client work, but I also deliver some educational courses. But I deliver some educational courses in the same hospital where I was once a patient.
Oh, wow.
So that is people, and I don't say that to glorify myself, but the reason I share that is always to give people the hope that wherever you are in your life, wherever, however dark it can get, you can turn things around. So we'll maybe get into that in a bit more detail later. But in terms of the medication, I mean, we touched on my journey. Things escalated in my journey where I needed medication.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was pretty not functional, which then led to a hospitalization at 17 years of age. So for me, it was a combination of antidepressant, antipsychotic medication to sort of at least get me to a place where I was feeling a bit better. So I suppose in a nutshell, for some people, medication can save a life. Also, medication can be useful, as I mentioned, in terms of the minor sort of when depression is there, when we have anxiety there, it can sort of keep those symptoms at bay. And then there are other people, Michelle, I work with, and currently even for a number of years, I personally don't take any medication anymore. There are clients I work with who are completely against it, and no matter, even if they need it, they have so much stigma around it.
It's a touchy subject for some.
Michelle, absolutely. I don't know what it is in your experience.
Oh, I hear 50-50. I mean, it's a personal choice. I just like people to have options, to be honest. I don't take either or side.
And I think it's recognizing that, Michelle, that some people, it's not our job as a therapist to advise anybody. If anything, that's the job of the medical professional. But I think when people do ask me, I give them that transparent that I've used it myself. But also, it's not for everybody. I remember being on a retreat pre-COVID, and there was different sort of journals and pens around this lovely sort of setting. Which again, and again, I'm not saying that you have to meditate in a fancy setting, but sometimes a retreat can be really useful if you can go on one now and again. Anyway, long story short, I started writing on this particular morning, obviously in silence, and this stuff just came out of me. And it eventually turned into a poem, and the poem was called "Your Mind Is Not Your Friend, But It's Not Your Enemy Either." And really what I mean by that, there would be no such thing as technology to do an interview like this. There'd be no such thing as the Eiffel Tower, no such thing as your favorite book or movie, if we didn't have this amazing creative brain. But sometimes that same brain can say things like, "You're not good enough," or "OCD is never going to improve," or "That door handle is contaminated, don't touch it." So it's almost like we can't sort of eradicate the negative stuff. So it's more, how can we learn to handle it when it shows up? And obviously that's where I suppose a big part of my work is, where you guys may or may not be familiar with it. I would do a lot of acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, in line with some mindfulness work, because I think the more flexible we can be with our thinking, the less we're dictated by thoughts, we have more choice, we have more flexibility. So like you said, having an obsessive tendency can be really useful in particular industries, in particular walks of life.
I'd love to hear both of your stories. I'm here sitting like, no, I do go check. I go back and check the door, but just maybe once. But that might be a cultural thing. When we talk about OCD, and obviously there's a lot of stigma surrounding the subject, what would be one thing that you want people to really know about this condition?
And Michelle, I suppose I've touched on it already, is that when people generally are in the heat of the moment, and obviously, Dr. Sal, you've had experience of this, you'll be able to hopefully resonate, is that it's almost like the thoughts are like this. It's like, that's all you can see. You can't really see anything else. You believe those thoughts to be biblical truth. So if you have the thought that, you know what, I'm not going to touch that door handle because it's contaminated, if you believe that thought to be true, well, understandably, you're not going to touch the door handle because you don't want to be contaminated. But a big part of how I work with clients is helping them to see that not all these thoughts are accurate. Not all these thoughts are true. That sometimes these thoughts are almost, as I mentioned, that sort of false alarm going off. And then what happens, that gives you a wee bit of wiggle room. So instead of the thought being here, it's almost like it's here. So the thought's there, we're acknowledging it hasn't gone away, but we still can look over here, we can still play with our kids, we can type on a computer, we can cook a meal. So a big part of the work that I do is helping clients to, I suppose, lessen the believability of a thought. Not take it away, but at least make it less believable. Because if a thought's less believable, it gives you a wee bit of choice in terms of what you can do next. And maybe a follow-on question that you're going to just share, because it came into my head. There's a nice exercise that an ACT therapist, Russ Harris, uses, and it's simply called Thanks Mind. Okay, so it's like a thought shows up, you know what, I'm not good enough, or a thought shows up that, you know, people don't like me. Okay, generally when those sort of thoughts show up, they go like that. They're so believable, they then affect how you behave. But this idea, okay, well, thanks for that thought, but I'm not going to follow that. You can play like a radio in the background, but I'm not going to be dictated by that particular thought. So a big part of the work that I do is helping people to see we all have thoughts, they all show up, but we have a choice whether we act on them or not. whether we believe.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question, by the way. Can you share any quick techniques that anybody could do at home?
Great question. And again, I could elaborate on that. So there's a, within acceptance and commitment therapy, they have a method called cognitive diffusion, right? And probably the most basic way to share that is sort of layman's terms. If you can imagine two pieces of metal, you know, like stuck together, fused together, there's no separation. That's almost what happens with us with our thinking sometimes, not just within OCD, but sometimes we get so hooked by our thoughts, we can't see anything else. So what cognitive diffusion is can we get a wee bit of wiggle room? Can we get a bit of space from these thoughts that they don't do what we do? So this is actually a written exercise that clients can do. So when I'm working with clients, I will, and I mean, anybody can do this. I will generally work with them and help them to pick a thought which is, does cause a little anxiety, but not off the Richter scale. So maybe someone might share the thought that, I have to wash my hands 10 times, okay? So I'm going to share this exercise, three different sentences very quickly. It can be really helpful to get a wee bit of space from the thought. First thing you do is write down, I need to wash my hands 10 times. You then skip a line. I'm having the thought that I need to wash my hands 10 times. Final sentence, I notice I'm having the thought that I need to wash my hands 10 times. I then ask clients, read that first thought out. I have to wash my hands 10 times. Mm-hmm. Then read out the last one. I notice I'm having the thought that I need to wash my hands 10 times. And then I'll ask, do you notice any difference in terms of believability, in terms of intensity, in terms of actually having to act on it? And they'll say something like,
yeah, how it feels.
They'll generally pause and they'll take a second and they'll generally say something like that. That first thought is just, I have to wash my hands 10 times. There's no other option. The last one.
Yeah, it's an absolute.
It's answer. An absolute. That last sentence is almost like, oh, I'm noticing that thought now. It's not here as such. It's more in the background. And sometimes clients will say, even if it's in the background, I may still have to wash my hands 10 times, but we're helping the client to see that over time, maybe I can do it less. Or maybe I can put a time delay in place that actually, I'm not going to do it straight away. And it's been my experience that even personally, because to this day, I will still get, and I suppose that's where the difference in my opinion between recovery and cure is I still get urges to do things. I still get intrusive thoughts. But the difference is, they're showing up like a radio in the background as opposed to front center, you know?
You're able to see it from afar. You'd be an expectator instead of having to
participate. Absolutely.
It almost reminds me of CBT. Well, I know it's ACT comes from the CBT. So it's just changing all the sort thinking and correct me.
No, and I think the mention that, because again, it's in case someone doesn't, you know, what we find within ACT, some of these diffusion exercises, they don't always, people will do that. It's actually, it doesn't help. That's okay. There's others to try. That I do like that one, the reading in the background, because what I mean by that is, if you imagine going to your local restaurant with your friend, family member, partner, I can nearly guarantee you there'll be some music playing, whether it's a live band in the corner or someone on the tannoy. And generally what happens in those situations, if it's a good song, if it's a song you like, you pay attention. But otherwise, you pay attention on your friends and family, on your meal, on the conversation you're having. So that music is continuing to play. But you should want to pay attention.
Yeah. I'm just laughing because it reminds me of parenting. So you have your kid just yap and you're like, I'm going to ignore that unless there's a cry of help. What about journaling? What do you think about that? What do you think about
journaling? I have a friend who swears by journaling. What she would say is it almost gives you like a mental break, because when something is in your head all the time and you find it difficult to talk about, you find it difficult to share, it can be very hard to sort of do anything productive or think in a more sort of positive way, when you get it on paper, when you see it for what it is, it at least gives you a wee bit of space. It doesn't make it away, but it gives you a wee bit of space. Then, as you mentioned, looking sometimes at the, which is again that sort of cognitive reframing type idea where we're going to look, look at the negatives. And then generally people will come to some sort of conclusion after that. My take on all of that, what I try and do with a client is, it's again within the sort of ACT tradition, is rather than looking at whether a thought is positive or negative, true or false, is a thought helpful or unhelpful? You know, so the example I would share, say someone has a thought that they like to maybe go for a walk the following morning. Okay, they sort of realize, you know what, I haven't been doing much activity. Going for a short walk might be helpful. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to get up and do that. Quite logically, quite normally within the human psyche, they may wake up tomorrow morning and they may be like, oh, it's the last thing I want to do. I don't feel like doing that. It's cold, it's wet outside. But then I will ask the client, in terms of actually following your value, in terms of you sort of said to yourself, that's what you want to do. If you follow the thought, I can't be bothered. Are you going to go for the walk or not? You know, and I will generally say, well, no, I'm not. So it's more than, okay, can we hold that thought? Can that thought be there while we still choose to do what's important? And that takes time, because most people see thoughts as blocks nearly, you know, whereas almost what really helped me and resonated so much with ACT is it's helped me to get the place that thoughts don't have to dictate what I do. You know, they can be there. Sometimes they're accurate, sometimes they're helpful. But if you look at your own life, sometimes they're not. Sometimes they're repetitive. Sometimes they're negative. Sometimes they're cyclical. Sometimes they don't move us in a positive direction. And it's recognizing that we don't always have to give them our full attention. But like you said, really useful tools to almost help you get there. Journaling, looking at the positive and negatives. My spin on it is that thought helpful? Or all helps.
I think journaling is good for everyone. Doesn't matter what diagnosis you have. That's just me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know I assign it a lot. Even, you know, it doesn't have to be a full page, super deep, because everybody gets in, some people get intimidated. You know, like, oh, just write whatever comes to mind, one sentence, we'll discuss it the next.
And I think.
So I think I go for journaling.
Yeah, and I think it can I think it can be sometimes the. When people feel it's a mandatory thing, that's when they can sort of shy away from it. They think, oh, it's another thing to do on the to-do list, you know, and it's potentially helpful, potentially can give them a mental break from that chatter.
I would like to ask you, as part of my last question, what advice would you give to someone that is starting their journey of recovery?
I will answer as best as I possibly can. I think when you begin a journey like that, I always admire the bravery of someone to at least even begin that journey, because generally with mental health, no matter what the diagnosis is, these people can feel very weak. They can feel that they're not good enough. They can feel that people don't understand them. But I will generally begin by, these people are some of the strongest people you'll ever meet, because some of them are still working, some of them have family, some of them are trying to live a good life while having these very debilitating, negative, self-destructive thoughts going on. So I start off with almost that self-compassion piece that, yes, you want things to improve, you recognize you want to go on this recovery journey, but let's start by not beating ourselves up. Let's start by not being too hard on ourselves. Then I suppose it's about educating yourself about the problem. You know, when I remember in my journey, when I was first diagnosed with OCD, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what it involved. The psychologist that I saw helped to fill in the blanks, of course. And when I looked at my experience, I knew what I was doing. But for a lot of people, like I said, Michelle, people generally just think, what is wrong with me? Am I losing my mind? Because something I haven't touched on, but within OCD, the thoughts, the literature around it, is they're generally the exact opposite of who they are. You know, it'll be that most loving, doting parent who will have the thought, what if I harm my child? It'll be someone who is very conscientious, someone who makes sure that doors are locked, make someone who makes sure that, you know, the stove's off at nighttime. They're the one that gets hit with the thought, what if it's not? You know, so I help people to see, which then gives a wee bit of calm in the room, that actually these thoughts aren't always accurate. Then it's always a little having the conversation of, I suppose, trying to maybe find a good therapist, trying to actually, if necessary, speaking to your GP about medication, finding good supports. I'm going to share an acronym which I find really useful. I talked about hope, and sometimes hope can be lost when you aren't feeling so good. A nice acronym I have for hope is hearing other people's experience. Hearing other people's experience. So maybe when it's hearing Dr. Sal's experience, when it's maybe hearing my experience, when someone can see that, you know what, he was once an inpatient. He once spent 8 weeks, 17 years of age at a psychiatric hospital. He was 18 with no qualifications to his name. Now he's turned his life around where he spends his life helping others. So if he can do it, there's hope for me.
In regards to the specialty of OCD, I know there are multiple therapists for multiple different diagnoses. But why do you think people specialize in OCD?
Another great question. I think I get that quite a lot with the clients that come to see me. If I get a DM on Instagram, people will say, I went to see this experience, went to see this previous therapist. They've been professional, they've been kind, they've been warm, but they haven't just got my problem. Or they've said things to me which haven't been so helpful. I remember actually working with there's a subtype of OCD called HOCD, and really what it means is if someone is, you know, heterosexual, they may have all these intrusive doubts about their sexuality. Again, when we look at the literature on OCD, intrusive thoughts are the exact opposite of who they are. So I remember this particular example of a client who went to see, again, kind, professional, understanding therapist, but basically thought this person had a sexuality problem as opposed to an OCD problem. So it's all these there that, you know, you suppose you have to be a specialist of. And I mean, this person was always saying to me, look, I've never been attracted to someone of the same sex. I have a long-term partner. This is something, you know, which I enjoy, I want to be part of, but I get so distressed by these thoughts, you know. And I think when people begin to see that actually these thoughts are not 100% biblical truth, when they're actually the opposite of who they are, it's almost like relief. It's almost like, wow, you know, that things aren't just going completely wrong, going completely awry. So I think, and especially as I'm sure you've heard that term exposure response prevention, which is sort of, not every therapist is sort of trained in that. Really the whole method behind that is we expose ourselves to the thing which causes anxiety gradually. And the response prevention piece means we don't do the behavior like we normally would. So the person who does wash their hands repeatedly, the person who does say a phrase so many times in their head, they begin to do it less without doing the ritual. And what happens, they feel anxious, they feel uncomfortable, but they begin to see, as I mentioned earlier, this fear isn't just as concrete as they initially thought, and that they can actually begin to sort of work around it. But it's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because I think it's specialist work, and probably as well why I went down that route. There's a lovely saying, the wounded becomes the healer. It's something which I know even in my own journey that there wasn't enough specialist help out there. There wasn't enough support. There wasn't enough education around the topic. And me being front and center and doing things like that hopefully can help people.
I think, yeah, that's very powerful. I love bringing people that are both, you know, in this mental health field, but that also went through their own healing journey with whatever diagnosis. So I can personally attest to that, that yes, I think you and people like you have a great impact on this world.
And thank you for that, Michelle. And it's sort of, it's a passion, and I'm sure it's the same with the work you guys do. I think that when you're passionate about something, and, you know, of course, self-care has to be involved with, you know, I myself in the process. But I think you can make a difference in someone's life. There's the ripple effect. You're then helping that person's family. You're then making a difference in that person's life outside of the therapy room. So yeah, I suppose for me, trying to be a shining example that recovery is possible.
Well, this has been a lovely conversation. I know I have learned a lot about OCD today. I want to thank you both for being part of this episode. And yeah, till next time, I guess.
You're welcome, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
If Paul's story hits home, share this episode. It could really help someone. Subscribe to see more interesting stories like this one.